Okay. We have no disclosures, and you can start talking.
I am actually the director of Bad Intervention Program Services here at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, and I think uniquely this practice sits within public health, and I have grown to appreciate that as someone who isn't necessarily coming from a public health background. And I was talking earlier about how, you know, we come out of the criminal justice system, so we're trying to meld these two areas together. And this is one example, I think, of how that is happening. So I just want to briefly talk to you a little bit about what batter intervention programs are. They really are for perpetrators of domestic violence, and the intent is to promote victim safety. And the promotion of victim safety really happens through holding the perpetrators accountable. And here in Massachusetts, what that means is there are a set of standards and guidelines which the department is promulgated to ensure happen in compliance with, that the programs, in order to complete a program, someone has to participate in a minimum of 80 hours of the program. And the dose is 2 hours a week, typically for 40 weeks. And I'll just insert this here. One of the reasons that many people drop out is because of substance use. So I think that's a really important thing to think about in that regard. So it really looks at it's a psychoeducational model. It looks at beliefs and learned habits and patterns and things that correlate with the perpetration of violence, and really challenges the individuals to think about what it is, who they are, what they've done, and to think about ways to change those behaviors. A really strong component of the work includes contact with the partners. And that contact happens sort of at the beginning and whenever it needed, but it is intended to help that individual connect with services that can be supportive to her or his needs, domestic violence services, to hear her thoughts and stories about her relationship with the perpetrator, to help her to understand what to expect out of batter intervention and particularly what not to expect. And then in an ongoing way, as the program understands perhaps the risk that the perpetrator could put the partner at, to contact her and to help her to understand that risk so that she can do some safety planning. The co-occurrence, as we know, and that's what brought all this together, there's a lot in the literature that we know there's a strong correlation between the perpetration of violence in general and the use of substances. And so having been in this field for almost over 20 years, actually, and looking at how people use substances, and then coming to understand in particular, I might be ahead of myself here, but that's okay, that binging is a risk factor for perpetration and for recidivism. And so since that's probably the majority of people, how do we think about changing how they consume substances? And how do we educate them so that binging and that drunkenness, which is a risk factor that victims and survivors talk about being fearful of, and I think that really depends upon who the individual is that's consuming the substances and who the victim is. Somebody could be drunker than somebody else and feel less threatened, et cetera, et cetera. So there's not a clear definition. I think it's a circumstantial definition, but clearly it's a use of alcohol that creates fear. And so that is a really important risk factor. And typically that drunkenness is not one of alcoholism, but is of binging. And so that's what we are working on and thinking about and have developed a curriculum to try to educate the group participants around.
Okay,
their,
we're going to get distinction for a little bit.
What's that?
It's not alcoholism, it's binging.
We're going to talk about that. Okay. Yeah. It's a very good point.
So this is it's like the chicken or egg. What comes first, the battering or the substance use? And that's really not the question that we need to answer. What we need to tease out for folks is to help them understand that they may be correlated, but they're separate. If I had a dime for every time I asked somebody, well, what do you drink? And they said, oh, Budweiser. And I said, well, if I had a can of Budweiser, would I behave like you did? And they look at me and they laugh and they sort of get it. It isn't the substances necessarily, but the correlation between those two and then teasing out the needs around those two things. And so I think there's been a shift in the substance abuse treatment world around this too, in terms of not necessarily seeing it as a causal relationship, but seeing it more as a correlative relationship, which I think is really important for our work. I think I did this. As Enid says, all of our we're congruent, and that's what that we worked really hard to sort of come to that place, I think. But I think we're there. We understand that. For me, having done groups for 17 years, I thought this is a perfect fit, and so we worked really hard to come to that mutual agreement. And I'm really excited about what we've done. So,
great, thank you.
We are a collaboration between the Department of Public Health. With Bob's division and the Bureau of Substance Abuse Services. I work at the Institute for Health and Recovery, a statewide not-for-profit agency that works on issues related to substance use, co-occurring disorders, trauma, and we provide direct clinical services, systems development, training, and a whole variety of on a variety of issues, and we work very closely with DPH. And I have done a lot of work with ESPRT, Screening Brief Intervention Referral for Treatment. How many of you are familiar with ESPRT? Oh, good. So in ESPRT, this is referring to your question there just a moment ago, we're doing, in this project and in all ESPRT work, we're screening for risk. We're not necessarily screening for dependence. That may come out at a certain point, but we're approaching people to determine the level of risk that their substance use indicates. Brief intervention is what we do after the screening, as you know, how we respond to it, and to have a conversation. And then in the rare case, that's a much smaller percentage of people that are screened that actually need referral to for a substance use assessment from an addictions professional to determine if that person does have dependence. So that's a little bit, that is the ESPRT approach. And our third author is the ESPRT coordinator from the Department of Public Health, who is also at an APHA meeting right now and isn't able to join us, Carol Gerard. So we know, everyone knows who knows anything about motivational interviewing, that the best way to support somebody to change is not to tell them to change, but it's to elicit their own reasons for change. And so we thought we would have an approach, take a motivational interviewing approach to this ESPRT pilot. And as Bob and his colleagues in the batterer intervention groups told me, the MI approach is very congruent with the work that the batterer intervention groups do themselves, trying to evoke change, develop relationships, you know, within the groups, engage, focus, and all of that. So that's the approach. And so what I wrote the original draft. It's been revised a number of times. And so we developed a curriculum that is based entirely upon motivational interviewing. And so instead of providing information, we ask questions of the group participants. And so I'm going to be showing you some of those questions, and then we just finished a pilot where I worked with group leaders at nine different settings in nine different groups, three different regional contexts, and also we're going to give you some examples. We are very mindful of the reality that of the existence of trauma in many of these individuals that we serve, and in all of the expert work that we do at the Institute for Health and Recovery, we always approach it through a trauma-informed lens. And so instead of just asking people, you know, just asking questions about substance use in our curriculum, we introduce screening and introduce this topic by just asking, why do you think this is important? And what would make it safer for you to answer these screening questions honestly? And that's just an example of a way that we want to encourage them to feel comfortable in talking about substance use. And we've had, and it's very exciting. When I said, why do you think this is important? They came up with all the reasons that it's important. And it takes, you know, it was so lovely. Instead of me saying why it's important and them resisting, it was quite moving. So then, before we do any screening, I ask, well, what is a drink? And this is always a popular question. And for years, I have been using my beautiful drink chart, which our media assistant at IHR spent a lot of time developing this chart, and we had it blown up, and so it's like poster size, and to show the different amounts of alcohol that make a standard drink, because soon I'm going to be asking them, how many drinks do you have? Well, I love this slide, but it didn't mean anything to them. This meant something to them. A lot of them know about malt liquor, and they were shocked to think that this is a particular kind called St. Ives that 40 ounces was worth 5 1/3 cans of regular beer. That was meaningful to them. So I have to go back to my office now and tell Jacob we need a new graphic. And also I found, we're in Massachusetts. Does anyone want to guess what one of the most popular drinks is for these batterers? What was that? I was shocked. Hennessy. Yes, cognac, they drink it. So then I asked a question, raise your hands if you got into trouble when you were drunk or high. And 3/4 of the group raised their hand. And one man said, oh yes, I had a police officer wish me happy birthday 5 times. Right? 5 years on his birthday, he would go out and get drunk. There's a lot of binge drinking. And so we, you know, this was just affirmation of the correlation that Bob in the literature talks about alcohol and drugs often being a disinhibitor to violence. And so then we asked, I wanted to ask, what percentage of people do you think drink at low levels or none? And what percentage of people drink at risky or dependent levels? So we had 3 different groups. We had one group that's southeast of Boston that's, I would say, a lot working class. We had another group in Jamaica Plain that is a very small group with men who had a lot of persistent and chronic mental illness. That group was led by a clinician. And then another group in Cambridge that was a mixture but had a lot of more professionals because it's Cambridge, right? And so when I asked this question, they said, oh, what percentage of people drink at risky or dependent levels? They said, oh, probably 85%. And then I pull out one of my pyramids, and they couldn't believe that there's only 25% of the population drinks at risky levels, and only 4 to 6% are dependent upon alcohol. They were shocked. Now, in the Southeast and the Boston groups, they were just shocked. In the Cambridge group, they questioned my data source. But again, in their lives, their peers all are heavy users. And we found in this small pilot that it was alcohol that was the biggest problem. It's the binge drinking. As opposed, they do use other drugs, but binge drinking was the most difficult. So we had, I have a chapter on health. Yeah, okay, 5 minutes. Have a chapter on health. And so I showed this, these are NIDA slide of a brain without cocaine, and then a brain, the middle one is cocaine abuser who's abused cocaine for 10 days, and then somebody who's abused cocaine for 100 days. So instead of me explaining this, I had this, and one man said, looking at this big poster, I've walked it around like, you know, Vanna on television, he said, I've been using cocaine for years and my brain has not been harmed at all. It turns out this is his third time in a batterer program. And so I would submit that it's possible cocaine has affected his brain. So Lisa Cruz from Massbird is here today. I want to thank her. She took all of the evaluations and produced these wonderful this wonderful data for us. We asked the men, they all filled out an anonymous evaluation. We had 143 men, and we asked them what they learned, you know, what the topic was. This is what they thought the topics were. And so then we asked them, we said that that the purpose of this group was, instead of telling you what to do, was to help you decide if you were making healthy and safe choices. So given that, how successful do you think that today's group was? And we were just, Bob and Carol and I were astonished to see that 37% of the men thought it was a very successful approach, and another 48% thought it was successful. So we were very heartened by that. Being the Massachusetts FASD coordinator, we talked a lot about the pros and cons of including information about prenatal alcohol use. Our concern was we did not want men to have an unfortunate or violent response to their partners, to their baby mamas, as they're described to me, because they were drinking alcohol. So we approached it very carefully. But what I didn't expect is, as I was talking about how alcohol can impact a child, adolescent, and adult throughout the stages, in each group we had at least one man who thought that he had an FASD himself, which is a whole nother pilot. So now we're going through, we're editing the curriculum, and we're going to be piloting it in other situations, and that's the presentation. We're very excited about it. Thank you.